Despite the promises from gyms and diet centers, Weight Watchers and diet pills, researchers are learning more about how individual body chemistry influences a person's weight, and they're making some progress. We'll talk about that. I'm also interested in the science of how the body reacts when you're trying to lose weight. It's part of the puzzle as to why we have such a hard time keeping the pounds off. And as we talk about the research, I'd like to hear from you. If you've lost weight, but you've struggled to keep it off, what have you learned about what works? And when you think of your perfect weight, is it reachable? Or are you setting yourself up to fail from the beginning? I'm asking this question because I've seen some interesting poll numbers about how people think of their perfect weight and how frequently or infrequently we actually reach that perfect weight. So if you have a perfect number in mind for your weight, is it reachable? Are you setting yourself up to fail? And if you've lost weight, but you've struggled to keep it off, what have you learned about that? What works? Some of the obstacles to that? Opportunity to talk about your experience with our experts today. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, at Kerri, KerriMPR. Our guest today, Kevin Hall, is a senior investigator at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, and he's with us today from Bethesda, Maryland. And Kevin, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Good morning, Kerri.
Victoria Jarosz-Bialski-Lindsay is with us today. She's a dietitian, a weight loss specialist, and owner of District Nutrition. And Tori, last time I talked to you, you were in Texas, so you've made the move to D.C., is that right?
That is correct.
Well, congratulations on that, and welcome.
Thank you.
Talk to you again. Kevin, I saw that in 2016, the NIH was supporting obesity research with more than $900 million. I want to ask you about the context of that. Is that a lot of money into obesity research when you look at all the money that goes into other research? And is some of that research going to understand how individual biology affects weight loss?
Yeah, it's a great question. I can't really speak to the funding of obesity research as a whole. My lab is kind of in the intramural program of the NIH. That's
okay.
Where we do our own research, so we're not in the business of actually funding other people's studies, so I don't have a lot of knowledge of that. Our research in my lab and others at the NIH here does investigate, you know, why it's so difficult for people to lose weight and keep it off. Are some diets better than others? Is there some sort of general diet that's better for others? What is the individual variability in weight loss? Those kinds of things have been of great interest to my research laboratory.
Do you feel like that researchers that do the kind of work you do are starting to kind of crack that code about individual biochemistry? Because a lot of the messaging around weight loss for years seemed to be, you put the calories in, you work them off, and this should work for everybody. So what's changed?
You know, it's a great question, and, you know, I'm trying not to be put a wet blanket on this discussion, but, you know, a lot of the research that we know about is that, yes, there, if you assign, for example, a bunch of people to a low-carb diet versus a low-fat diet, they tend to do on average about the same over, you know, 1 or 2 year period in terms of weight loss. But within each of those groups that were assigned to those diets, there are some people who lose an enormous amount of weight, and then there are others who even gain weight. And so there's been a lot of emphasis, renewed emphasis now, in trying to predict who were the successes and who were able to lose weight. And is there some conflict between the biology of that person and the diet that they were assigned to? The recent data on that actually suggests that the things that we thought might predict who might be successful on one diet versus another did not actually predict the results.
Uh-huh.
So while there's a lot of hype about personalized nutrition and this idea that, you know, we might be able to match some specific diet to your particular biology, there's no good data to support that for weight loss.
So, Tori, you own District Nutrition, so you're advising individuals on how to approach this. What do you say about kind of this longtime conventional wisdom that, you know, one size fits all? And then I hear what Kevin is saying. We don't know enough about how individual biochemistry affects it, but it does seem to be a place for further research. So how do you speak to clients about this?
Sure. No, that's a really great question. So I agree totally. And I'm sure Kevin's seen it and I've seen it myself that people do succeed at weight loss. It's incredibly difficult, but it does happen. And the catch is that some people appear to succeed with virtually every diet approach. It's really just going to vary from person to person. So I think it's really important to communicate to people that when you're trying to lose weight, there needs to be some trial and error that goes on. Also, I think that we can, when we think of obesity is a really complicated, multifactorial disease. And so there's not going to be one singular answer when it comes to treating obesity and maintaining weight loss. As far as things that we can look, and Kevin alluded to this, but there are some similarities that we can look to and we can use as kind of starting points. A really great example of that is the National Weight Control Registry. It's an ongoing research study that's tracked over 10,000 individuals, and they have found some commonalities between people that have been successful at weight loss. For example, I think it's like 90% of the people that have been successful with weight loss in their study exercise over an hour per day. And 75% of them weigh themselves at least one time a week. So there are some behavior things, at least, that we're able to look at and see, okay, well, this is helpful. This is a starting point. And these are some solid pieces of advice that we can give people that they can kind of build off of.
Okay, I'm going to come back on the exercise because, I have questions
about... A lot to say about that.
I know, how influential it is in weight loss. But we have a lot of callers, and let me get to that. To Vernon in Minneapolis. Hey, Vernon, what's this been like for you?
Hey, I was a college football player, and at my heaviest, I was 280. Uh-huh. I successfully lost 40 pounds, but now my cycle is I exercise every day. I lose weight Monday through Friday, but on the weekend, I gain it all back.
Really?
And I just keep going in this cycle. And I'm struggling with reducing my intake over the weekend. And that's my big struggle.
So Vernon, you are eating differently, it sounds like, on the weekend. And why you're putting the weight back on.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. The weekend I go... It's the weekend, right?
Time to have fun,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Kevin, you've heard stories like that, right? I restrict myself and then I let things go just a tiny bit and then the weight just comes right back on. How unfair is that?
At least Vernon recognizes when his problem areas are and can target those. I mean, a lot of people, lose weight for a period of time, then stop losing weight, and they're mystified as to why this is not working anymore when they're doing the same things according to, the best of their recollection. I think it's a great step forward that Vernon recognizes that on the weekends he regains the weight that he lost over the course of the week, and he can work with someone like a registered dietitian like Victoria or someone else who can then help them target those particular times and come up with strategies to cope with the weekends.
Tori, I was under the impression from reading, in preparation here for the show, that constant restriction of calories, your body starts to adjust to that and then works against you on the restriction. So it sounds like some of what Vernon is doing is easing up a little bit during the week shouldn't be such a bad thing. Talk to me about how that works, the restriction idea.
So I think Vernon brings up a really important point, which is this idea of this fantasy, I should say, of a maintenance phase, or I'm going to work really hard, I'm going to get down to my goal weight, whatever that may be, and then I can hit maintenance and I can loosen the reins and I can indulge a little bit more. But what people don't understand is whatever you have to do to lose the weight, you're probably going to have to maintain those behaviors and that way of eating indefinitely if you want to keep the weight off.
Wow, because indefinitely. Wow.
I mean, most likely, and Kevin can speak to that more because I know that's what a lot of his research focuses on, but physiologically, your body is going to fight that weight loss. Again, it's not impossible, but it's really, really difficult. So again, I think it's important for people to wrap their head around the idea that, however you're eating, however you're exercising to lose that weight, you need to continue it. And so I think it's also important to, when you're looking at that as a whole and you're trying to design whatever your diet's going to be, you're trying to find a better way to eat, you're trying to find a better way to be active, what do you enjoy? What can you sustain long term? because torturing yourself and over-restricting isn't going to work in the long run.
Lauren says on Twitter, cutting added sugar did most of the work for me, 60 pounds, but once I started eating it again, almost immediately, I gained again. Kevin, why do our bodies work against us to maintain the weight loss? That seems so unfair.
Yeah, it might seem unfair. I guess this is one of the cruel tricks of evolution, that we were designed to kind of keep energy stores on our bodies to survive periods of famine. And, of course, we don't have in the U.S. and most Western nations now periods of famine to worry about. And so as we try to cut our calories in our diet or try to exercise and burn more calories, what ends up happening is that our body senses that we're in this deficit of calories and basically slows down your metabolic rate, which is the number of calories your body's burning just, at rest, just when you're not even moving around, to try to compensate for those adjustments. Not only that, but you also get hungrier. And so you'll have an appetite that's higher, and that makes it more difficult for you to sustain those changes. That's why I think it's really important what Victoria was saying, that whatever changes you're going to make in order to lose weight, you have to be willing to put up with those for the rest of your life in order to keep the weight off. It's not impossible. People can do it. It's in the kind of the change in your lifestyle that you're willing to make and you can enjoy over the long term is, I think, the thing that people need to mostly focus on.
When you say your metabolic rate slows, is that also kind of a permanent thing, or with exercise can you increase it, or does it come back naturally?
Yeah, so we did a study with the folks that participated in the Biggest Loser competition. So they participated in a huge amount of exercise, and actually most of them, many years after participating in that competition, continue to do a lot of exercise. Unfortunately, that did not prevent the slowing of the metabolic rate, which did seem to be persistent over many years. It really speaks to this issue that, you can't think of weight loss as a temporary thing that you can, hold your breath for a period of time, and the analogy being to cut calories by more than you would be willing to do for a long period of time, just to lose a lot of weight and then expect that you can relax the reins thereafter and not regain weight afterwards. You really need to think about the kinds of healthy lifestyle changes that you can incorporate permanently into your life, because these biological changes will be persistent over a long period of time.
Kevin, just a quick word on this Biggest Loser research that you did, because I was reading about it. For one thing, the level of exercise and intensity that those people are engaging in that competition just seems, I don't know how you'd have time in your day when you're living a normal life to get that kind of exercise.
No, I think that's the point.
It is.
While they're in this program, in this competition, they are removed from their day-to-day life.
Right.
And they are engaging in completely unsustainable diet and exercise practices in an attempt to lose weight as rapidly as possible. It was a competition, and it's televised. And so the point there is that, it was clear from the outset that these folks could not sustain this kind of lifestyle change over the rest of their life. And so it was, pretty obvious that they were going to regain at least some of the weight that they lost. What was surprising to some of the researchers who investigated them was, number one, how active they remained. So they are actually still pretty active, not anywhere near as active as they were on the television program, but relative to most people, they're very active. And number two, that they, despite regaining some of the lost weight, their metabolic rate continued to be very slow relative to what it should have been.
You're listening to a conversation here about obesity, where scientists and researchers are investigating to understand it better, how your individual body chemistry may influence that. We've been talking about exercise, one of my favorite topics, and disappointingly, it's not the silver bullet for weight loss, which is kind of a drag. So Tori Lindsay with us. She's a dietitian and owner of District Nutrition in Washington, D.C., and Kevin Hall with us, senior investigator at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. Again, that is not to say that you shouldn't be exercising, because it's got all kinds of other benefits, but it's interesting to hear our guests talk about where exercise fits in specifically to weight loss. I'm asking you today, if you've lost weight but you've struggled to keep it off, What have you learned about what works? What are you encountering as an obstacle? And when you think of your perfect weight, is it reachable? Do you have a perfect weight in mind? And maybe that's part of the problem right there. But, you know, you're really setting yourself up to fail. Should it be more about fitness and health? We'll ask our guests about that as well. How about for you? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. On Twitter, at CarrieNPR, where Nikki says, for me, weight loss is a psychological, emotional issue. Read Intuitive Eating, and I have finally beat binge eating. She says, however, the amount of sugar, high fructose, corn syrup put into everything we eat by companies is a factor as well. To the phones, to Tom in St. Paul. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing good. What's your story with this?
Well, I am a pretty active cyclist. I lost 90 pounds about 15 years ago and have kept it off by biking. And I recently did a tour of Africa, 11,000 kilometers.
Wow.
And lost about 20 pounds on top of my weight. But on return, I gained it all back really quickly and then some. And I was struggling with what happened. And what I found is that my metabolic rate actually declined or decreased quite a bit, and I had to figure out what was going on there. And part of it is my age. I'm 63 and testosterone, all that type of thing. But I really found that it was a lot of just the fact that after writing all that way, my body became just super efficient.
Uh-huh.
I wondered if you could comment on that. I think that's part of the dilemma. As we get good at it, we get good at it.
Yeah, yeah, good point. Tori, what are you hearing that?
Oh, that to me sounds like a Kevin question. That is his research. That is right up his alley. Sorry,
Kevin.
I have to toss that one to you.
Kevin,
sure,
what are you hearing?
My pleasure. So, first of all, one of the things that's important to note in this caller is mentioning that he was able to lose weight and keep it off over the long term with added exercise. And I think Tori mentioned this previously, that is a common factor. People who do incorporate exercise into their daily life are able to better maintain weight loss. It might not help that much during the active phase of weight loss, but maintaining it afterwards is it's important to kind of keep that exercise going. But with respect to this question of whether or not, you know, you become more efficient at performing certain exercises, of course that does happen. It's hard to know in this particular case whether or not this person's metabolic rate actually did remain slow or slowed down and then stayed down after this extraordinary cycling trip through Africa. Those measurements are not readily available for folks. Like most clinicians that you'll visit, will not have access to the kind of equipment that will be able to measure those things. There's a lot of day-to-day variability in that measurement, and you have to be very careful about how you prepare people ahead of time. So it's very difficult to know if that's actually what happened in this individual case without kind of research-grade testing.
Tori, I want to come back to you on exercise, though. You hear me.
Sure.
I love to talk about exercise, but when it comes to weight loss, how influential is it? I know it's a healthy thing to do.
Oh, absolutely. But first I have to ask you, Carrie, what's your favorite way to work out?
So each night I switch out between body pump and body attack and cardio. So
oh, okay.
I'm at the gym like 6 days a week for mental clarity, Tori. It's not
yes.
really about, you know, I want to be fit, but this is really about focusing the mind, and I feel good when I exercise.
And you hit the nail on the head. I think that needs to be the single largest motivator in getting people to exercise is not for the number on the scale. It's
really?
For your overall well-being. Because think about it. I mean, first of all, you know, when you look at the balance, if you were to simply reduce it to calories in, calories out, which is a little reductive, but let's go with it for right now. A single bottle of Coke would require the average person, let's say who weighs around 150 pounds, to jog for, say, like 45 minutes to an hour,
wow.
assuming they have a normal metabolism, which doesn't seem worth it, right? It would seem
right.
better to control your food intake than it would to exercise and burn away, so to speak, the food you're eating in an attempt to lose weight. But also you just have to look at the bigger picture where, let's say you're trying to lose weight and you, again, we're going to assume that in a perfect world, our calories work, or our bodies work in perfect math and that calorie science is perfect. But let's say you're creating a calorie deficit of 500 calories a day through exercising and through reducing your intake. And so that would mean over a week, you would have burned 3,500 calories, which is approximately equal to 1 pound. So you're killing it. You're going to the gym every night like you're doing. You're really watching your food intake. You're doing all of that for only 1 pound a week. So at the end of a month, you've only lost 4 pounds. Who is happy with a weight loss of only 4 pounds? Most of us would throw in the towel. It doesn't seem worth it for the effort, especially if you're going above and beyond and you're over-restricting yourself and it's not something that you necessarily enjoy. So I think coming back to exercising not for weight loss but for overall well-being, I think it's really important to, again, identify what is it that I like to do and look at different measures and use that as a way to measure your progress and look at, you know, improving your health, whether it's looking at an improvement in blood pressure or perhaps an improvement in level of fitness versus simply exercising for weight loss, because that is a losing game.
So, Tori, what's your favorite exercise?
I'm really into Pilates right now.
Oh.
I like to run, but I'm on a Pilates kick.
See, Pilates has never felt hard enough to me. Like I'm
but
really.
But that's the thing.
Yeah.
It's so different for every single person, and I truly believe I work in public health now as well as having my private practice. But I truly believe that there is some type of activity, there is some type of movement that is for everyone. So there's no need to torture yourself and punish yourself by only committing to one type of activity.
So, Kevin, here's Amy on Twitter who says intermittent fasting, 20 fast, 4 hour eat, lowers insulin, taps into fat stores. It works and I feel great. What do you think of fasting, Kevin?
Well, first of all, good for her. As long as, you know, again, I think that it's one of those things that, you know, there's not strong data that suggests that any one kind of program is going to work for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There's a recent study that came out which looked at intermittent fasting compared with the continuous calorie restriction that we've been sort of downplaying over the past several minutes on this program, and found that there was actually no difference between weight loss with intermittent fasting compared to calorie restriction.
Interesting.
So, you know, but if it, again, within each group of people who were assigned to either one of those programs, there were some people who did extraordinarily well and some people who actually gained weight. And so, you know, I think the mystery is still out there. Is it some particular confluence between the biology and the diet assignment, or is it simply that those folks would have done equally well had they been assigned to the opposite? They were just at the right point in time in their life. They had the kind of social support and whatnot that we often don't think about, but could be equally important factors in contributing to an individual's success.
Call here from Linda in Minnetonka. Linda, what's your story with this? Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Linda. What's your story with this?
Well, my story is that I was an avid diet all my life, exercise. I even became a nutritional weight and wellness coach. And I realized that when I, not even knowing that I was connecting emotions to food, every diet that I did, I lost weight and realized that the weight was just a symptom of something that was going on, what I was holding emotionally.
Hmm.
So once I got rid of my abandonment issues, once I got rid of, you know, feeling depressed or lonely or sad, or, you know, the emotional eating stopped.
Wow.
And so basically it's addressing the emotions that people are linking to food, which really should be linked to, say, a parent or a barbecue or, you know, things like that. And I did that accidentally. And so that's my story.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I,
good to
and
have
I
it.
Just naturally lost weight once I started dealing with my emotions.
Yeah, I want to, like, Linda, I appreciate that. I want to ask about emotional eating. It's a term we hear a lot, Tori. I mean, what is it really?
So food, by design, especially certain foods like carbohydrate, can have a mood-altering effect. You know, it can increase levels of chemicals in our brain that cause us to feel happy. Food is also an enjoyable experience, right? It's enjoyable to eat food that we like. And so that can be a way that people self-soothe. And so I think that Linda brings up a really good point, and it's something that I've said time and time again that I don't think is addressed enough, is it's not just important what we eat. That's certainly important. And as a dietitian, I'm not going to discount that. But I think that how and why we eat and our relationship to food is also really, really important. And some of the clients I've seen over the years have really balked at my suggestion to see a therapist, whether it's a psychologist, a psychiatrist, some kind of therapist, because I think for many of the clients, I can give them all the information on what foods to eat or perhaps what nutrients they may be lacking. And I can give this really detailed nutritional advice, but it's not really, it's only going to be part of the puzzle. They need to address this relationship with food. They need to address how they eat and why they eat and how they view food. And I think that's going to be far more effective than any talk about nutrients or food groups is going to be for them.
James says online, I lost 58 pounds, have kept it off for 3 years. That's really impressive. The biggest lesson I've learned is to read food labels. There's sugar, carbs, and everything. I also eliminated my diabetes. Here's Joan Kevin on Twitter who says, the worst thing I ever did was to eat low fat. Low carb is the only thing that works for me to lose and keep the weight off. Was low fat just kind of an illusion and permission for people to stuff in a lot of calories?
I think the messaging surrounding that and the advice that people gave that all that mattered was for you to kind of look at the fat content of your food and anything else goes was probably a big mistake. I would argue that probably similarly these days, the advice has swung to just looking at the sugar content and anything else goes. That might also be a big mistake. But the callers or the Twitter person is right that this idea that one specific diet is going to work for everybody and that all that we need to do is target one evil nutrient that was responsible for, you know, obesity, and that would cure all our problems is probably a much too simple approach to be thinking about this problem.
Another call here from Nathan in Cottage Grove. Hi, Nathan. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hey.
Hi. What's your experience?
So prior to Easter weekend of this year, I weighed 173 pounds. I had a scheduled tonsillectomy, and that basically reduced my caloric intake to almost nothing for the following 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I dropped to 143 pounds.
That's a lot of weight.
Wow. So I've been able to maintain that by just not changing my diet, but just reducing the amount that I eat, because I think my stomach shrunk. So I've heard differing opinions on whether or not that actually happens, but I can eat a quarter of what I was eating and feel full.
Wow.
The second point I want to bring up is, I have 14 years in the military, and in 2013, they started the Army Body Composition Program. You know, make soldiers maintain standards for their height, weight.
Mm-hmm.
And exercise is not a requirement for healthy weight loss, according to the program.
Huh.
That's your
experience with this. Kevin, what about that 30-pound weight loss and Nathan's theory that his stomach has gotten smaller and that's how he's keeping it off?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I think it's an intriguing one. We know that there are, you know, some forms of surgery that people do which just sort of band around the stomach. They don't actually replumb the internal organs like some of the more sophisticated ones, but that does lead to persistent weight loss. So this idea that the stomach sends signals to the brain telling you when you're full after meals, I haven't heard the idea that, you know, there might be some permanent reduction in stomach size that might alter that signaling in some persistent way following just a period of unintended weight loss like he experiences. But you know, there is this idea that your relationship with food and your usual patterns, and if you were able to sustainably change those patterns over time, no matter what the impetus, it might be, you know, your unintended weight loss, like was mentioned here, or something intentional, that you're able to maintain a consistent pattern that is allowing you to eat fewer calories, may allow you to keep that weight off, and it might have nothing to do with the size of your stomach.
Now, I'm getting a lot of questions here about the microbiome, so we'll come back and we'll talk about that with Kevin and Tori. And I was also reading some research about how we start to put on weight in young adulthood. And even though it might be a pound a year, you know, your fat mass steadily accumulates year after year. And you may get into your late 40s and early 50s and find yourself with, you know, like an extra 25 or 30 pounds. So I want to talk to them about that as well. And of course, more of your calls and your questions, your experience with taking weight off and obstacles and successes to maintaining that weight loss. And if you've got in your mind that that number that is reachable or perfect, kind of the perfect weight you'd like to be, I think all of us indulge in the idea of that sometimes. Do you feel like you're setting yourself up to fail, or is that something that has worked to motivate you? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Back in just a minute, more of your calls and your questions, but to Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Kerri. Hurricane Maria slammed into Puerto Rico this morning with 150-mile-per-hour winds. The storm is now hitting areas hard hit by Hurricane Irma. An advisor to Dominican Prime Minister Roosevelt Skerrett says there have been 7 confirmed deaths in Dominica from Hurricane Maria. That makes 9 overall from that storm. The Israeli military says it is sending a 70-member delegation to Mexico to assist with rescue efforts following a magnitude 7.1 earthquake. A military spokesman says the delegation is expected to arrive in Mexico tomorrow. Mexicans are volunteering to wriggle into a collapsed school building after the quake. So far, the bodies of 21 children and 4 adults have been pulled out, and rescuers are still hearing noises from within. The school was 3 stories tall. Mexican officials say 225 people have died in that quake. The U.S. and Iran will have their highest-level interaction of Donald Trump's presidency today. It's a day after Trump criticized Iran and a nuclear deal with that country at the U.N. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Iran's foreign minister are both expected to attend a EU-hosted meeting today. Countries have started signing on to the first treaty to ban nuclear weapons. It's backed by over 100 nations, but nuclear-armed nations want no part of it. Brazil's president was the first to sign at a ceremony today at the UN. And U.S. home sales fell 1.7% in August, pulled down by the effects of Hurricane Harvey and a worsening shortage of available properties. The National Association of Realtors says sales of existing homes sank last month to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 5.35 million. Would-be homebuyers are being limited by a decline in the number of listings. The shortage has become a drag on sales and has caused prices to climb sharply. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:39.
Coming up on All Things Considered, neonicotinoids have been linked to declining bee populations for nearly a decade. Now researchers are looking at whether the insecticides could be affecting birds. I'm Tom Cran. Join me for that and all the day's news starting at 3.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up on NPR News, our next conversation in the series on healthcare, Andy Slavitt, a Minnesota guy who used to run Medicaid and Medicare, will get his thoughts on the current bills in Washington and what healthcare and health insurance should look like. All of that at 11.
Hey, what do you get when you check out my podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts? Well, you get all these shows. So if you can't listen to the whole hour on obesity or what health insurers want from health reform, it's waiting right there for you on the podcast. You also get Flyover, our national call-in show about American identity. I do it on Sundays. Also waiting right there for you on the podcast. Check it out.
Programming supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities, and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
Back to the conversation now on obesity. Tori Jarzabkowski, Lindsay is with us. Does this mean I can drop that very difficult last name of yours, Tori, and just call you Tori Lindsay?
That's fine.
Perfect. She's a dietitian and owner of District Nutrition. And Kevin Hall is with us. He's a senior investigator at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. I want to ask you, for both of you first, before we go right back to the calls here. I was reading some research, Kevin, from Frank Hugh at Harvard, who says we start to put on weight during young adulthood. And even though it's a pound a year, this fat mass steadily accumulates year after year. By the time you're in your mid-50s, you've put on 35 or 40 pounds, and that is particularly difficult to lose. What do you observe on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we've talked about the obesity epidemic many times in the past, and, you know, I think that one of the most worrying parts is the increase in childhood obesity. And, you know, we actually don't know the consequences, the long-term consequences of kids who become obese very early in age. And, you know, we know that there's an increased incidence of very young people getting type 2 diabetes, for example, which was formerly called adult onset diabetes. And
wow.
Now we had to change the name because, of course, we have a lot of kids that are developing diabetes. And so we actually don't know how to manage these chronic diseases that are associated with obesity when they start so early in life. And I think that's a real problem for our public health system, and it's something that we really need to focus a lot of attention on. You know, some people have joked in the past that, you know, adults that develop obesity in adulthood, well, we can just kind of give up on them. We really need to focus on the children. I don't think I'd go quite that far.
Okay.
But the point is that, you know, prevention of obesity in children is really a top priority.
Call here from Heather in West St. Paul. Hi, Heather. How do you think about this?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I love this topic. I wanted to speak toward the importance of really finding community and social support in the place you exercise.
Good.
I felt that my trainer had my back in every way, nutritionally, exercise, and I ended up losing 104 pounds over about 18 months.
Oh, my gosh. That's incredible. Wow. Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks. I'm coming up on 5 years in the gym, and actually I run the gym that I lost all my weight at, and I'm a trainer here too now, and I love it.
It's good.
But it was mostly through strength training and actually heavy lifting, and then I added on cardio. But super quickly, my results kind of became my own motivator, and my trainer didn't pay much attention to my weight. You know, you asked about your perfect weight.
Right.
And you were like, maybe it's not about that. We measured my body composition, and it was with the pinchers, and it was uncomfortable, but it let me know that I was losing about a steady 1% body fat per month. And he just kept telling me, trust the process. And I think that's really important for people to understand. You know, you might not see it in the mirror, but you're looking at yourself every day. So find a measurement tool that can give you numbers and really quantify. So we don't have to use those pinchers anymore, thankfully. We have more advanced tools. But that's, I think, is really key.
What's the gym you run, Heather?
I'm at the Anytime Fitness in West St. Paul.
Okay. Well, congratulations on this. Tori, what do you think about what she's saying about the numbers to pay attention to?
I like that she brings up body composition in particular. When I was working in a weight loss research study at University of Texas at Austin, we would use the DEXA body composition scan, which isn't readily available to everyone, but it was a really good tool. And I can't tell you how many people would come in and they would be working through our exercise programs and they would be so discouraged because, again, they'd been working so hard throughout the course of the study in their program and they hadn't lost any weight. And then they would see that maybe while they lost, say, 5 pounds of fat, they added 3 pounds of muscle. And so the percent change, their body fat percentage decreased more than they may have thought since they were just looking at the scale, you know, that they were using in their own home.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that, you know, looking at a different metric, whether it's body fat percentage or blood pressure, is actually really sensitive to changes in exercise. So as you get more fit, your blood pressure is going to change. That can be a good metric to look at. You can also look at things like, you know, maybe you can lift heavier weights, or maybe, you know, you can set a goal to run a mile or to run a 5K or walk a 5K or, you know, whatever it may be. But I think we need to shift away from looking at weight as a measure of success to so many other metrics as a measure of success. I think it's good to measure and track things. That's certainly very motivating. But the scale, again, is just setting you up to fail.
And even if you're not seeing what you want to see on the scale, you're probably noticing it with the way your clothes fit and your level of fitness and your, you know, you're able to run longer or walk faster. I mean, I hear you on the measures, and they don't have to be all that sophisticated from
sure.
your own observation, right?
Right. I mean, yeah, you can go get your DEXA body composition scan done, and it's great. And it's going to tell you a lot. But again, you know, whether it's, you know, measurements or whether it's, you know, using something else, I think we can find better numbers to look at.
This is interesting. Buffy in St. Paul called. She says, personal control and what you eat. I took a picture of everything I ate. This allowed me to lose 40 pounds. What do you think about that, Kevin? We're all carrying around cameras in our phones, or many of us are. What do you think of that as a technique?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a more sophisticated way of doing what people, dietitians have known for years, that is tracking what people are eating, and maybe even important when they're eating, is an important part of losing weight. In other words, just being more cognizant of what you're eating, when you're eating it, maybe thinking about what's motivating you to eat those things, is something that people have known for a very long time as a factor that that folks have used. Unfortunately, in the past, it has been extremely, you know, tiresome to take all of those records. But, you know, maybe with phones and whatnot, with their cameras, that might be a little bit easier.
Yeah. Kyle says on Twitter, in my 20s, I thought my ideal weight was 230-ish. I'm 6'5". In my 40s, I got down to under 220 and realized that's where I need to be. Kevin, to come back to you on, are people cognizant enough of what your best weight should be? I think I've seen studies that say people underestimate their weight and overestimate where they ought to be.
Yeah, so, I mean, a couple of points on this. One is that people have to realize that the majority of the differences between people's size is explained by genetics. So most of the variability that you see between person A and person B is primarily due to genetic differences.
Okay.
And, you know, we know that people, you know, obesity has increased over the past several decades, and that has primarily been due to environmental changes. And there's a whole host of those that we could talk about. So, you know, defining an ideal weight for one particular person is complicated by the fact that we don't know what the genetic makeup of that person is and what, you know, how that it should be defined. I like the idea of the best weight, and a colleague of mine in Ottawa has kind of coined that term to basically mean whatever weight your body settles at when you're making the most healthy lifestyle choices that you can make and yet still enjoy your life.
Okay.
And so this notion that you should have a target weight that's defined by some, you know, algorithm somewhere is probably too simple. And we need to really factor in these questions about, you know, what sustainable changes you can make in terms of your lifestyle that are healthy, that will allow your body to naturally go down to a lower weight.
What do you say to the people that you work with around, you know, where their goals realistically ought to be and how they ought to think about that weight for long term?
Sure. Well, I remind a lot of the people that come in to see me that are struggling with being overweight or obese that, you know, even a reduction of 5 to 10% of their body weight is going to result in metabolic changes, assuming, you know, positive metabolic changes, assuming that they're trying to eat more healthfully and that they're starting to exercise and being more active. So I often try to shift the conversation away from weight. And again, just talk more in terms of health, find other goals, find other metrics. Because people's expectations for, again, what their weight should be are so skewed and all over the place. And as Kevin mentioned, it's an imperfect science. So I don't want to place all this emphasis on an imperfect science and an imperfect measurement, because it just doesn't make sense.
Kara says here on Twitter, and boy, this is true. She says, I reached my goal weight after 11 months of calorie counting and daily exercise. It was tough, though. Minnesotans are real food pushers.
It's the Midwest. That's what we do in the Midwest.
Don't they, Kevin, you live in Maryland. Tori, you're living in D.C. They push food there, too, don't they?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the factors that we've, you know, come to realize is that, you know, there have been huge changes in the, you know, our food environment that have, you know, probably played a large role in generating the obesity epidemic. And, you know, when you try to take an individual person and say, you know, we're going to have you lose weight and or try to change your lifestyle, we have to be cognizant of the fact that we're living in this environment, which is generally not changing. And so one of the factors that people have used in the past, and Tori can probably speak to this, is how do you re-engineer your personal food environment? How do you, you know, re-engineer your route to work so that you don't always stop by the Starbucks every day and get your, you know, grande latte with, you know, whipped cream or whatever? You know, how do you re-engineer those cues in your environment that normally would cause you to think about consuming food that you're not really hungry for? And so I think that those kinds of strategies at the individual level to combat these changes at the societal level of our food environment that has changed dramatically that have probably caused most of the obesity epidemic.
Kevin, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for doing this. Boy, just tons of great information here.
Thanks for having me.
Tori, also want you to talk a little bit about re-engineering your food environment. Just some tips to do that. I think that would be important to have that.
Okay, sure. One resource for anyone is to look at Cornell University. They've done a lot of work, Dr. Brian Wansink in particular, looking at different ways that we can cue ourselves to eat less because, you know, like Kevin said, our environment is not set up to make the healthy choice the easy choice, which was part of the impetus for me going into public health, still maintaining my private practice, but it was so frustrating to work with clients and to give them all this nutrition knowledge and to try and teach them these skills and then to unleash them in an environment where their knowledge and their, you know, what they're trying to do is not supported. So simple things like using smaller plates and dishes, making sure that you're filling your house with healthy food that you actually enjoy eating, you know, not the stuff that you feel like you should be eating and it sits and it wilts, you know, in the vegetable crisper in your fridge, you know, making sure that you have healthy snacks available to you, whether it be in the car, at work, in your home, and cueing yourself to eating things like that. I think those are all really just very simple, very easy ways to kind of cue yourself to make the healthy choice and to kind of reinforce that commitment that you have to changing your lifestyle. But again, I would really recommend the research coming out of Cornell. They have a book called Mindless Eating that's really good. They also have some books that are more targeted towards children. So, whole host of ideas that are too numerous to list right now.
We've had Brian on the show. I mean, the
experiments. He's fantastic, isn't he?
Well, he just creates these diabolical experiments.
Oh,
you know,
he's such a clever researcher. Definitely.
He puts a tube under the table and soup gradually comes back into your bowl. It's hilarious. Tori, really good to chat with you again. Thanks so much.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Tori Lindsay, dietitian and owner of District Nutrition.